Well, hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the 343 Podcast, where we work to elevate the level of discourse and practitionership here in American soccer. Today, I have Benny on the line. He wanted to talk about the 343 Masterclass. This is the parent education program that we have been developing over a number of years. We dive into its origins, how it started out as a personal training program, and then evolved and developed into a parent education program because one of the things that I realized, you know, a long time ago, but even more appreciated nowadays, is just how influential the household is and the parents actually are at any age, the earliest ages, the teenagers, and even post-youth soccer ages. So I think it's important to give them a tool, an instrument, a powerful one at that, so that they can guide their kids in a much, much better way, in a much more informed and educated way, in a way that they can discern, you know, fact from fiction out there in the marketplace. But in any event, Benny really tried to get me to dive into the five components of player development. These are five components that are eternal, evergreen. These are the sorts of things that never change. They are fundamental principles. And that is a great starting point for us to have this discussion. In the beginning, I have a little bit of a powwow with him with respect to the academic setting, specifically at the university level where I teach. And I think there's a lot of commonalities in what has happened to the youth nowadays versus maybe what the youth was 10, 15, 20 years ago. Again, the principles are the same, but there's a lot of commonalities between sport and academics. I think a lot of parents will find that interesting. But okay, you know, I won't belabor the point. Let's dive right on into the episode with Benny Rogers regarding parent education and the masterclass. Oh, and coaches, this is a good one for you too. But per usual, give me 15 seconds here to direct folks to what sponsors this program. First up, the 343 Masterclass itself, the parent education program itself. Parents, get on over to 343masterclass.com. The program is now open. You can see the links there. They are live. You can just click and join up in a matter of minutes. So I think that's very important. And then, of course, coaches, we started with you in 2013. The program is better than ever. We've been going strong for over 10 years. Thousands of coaches have learned the methodology from Brian Kleiben, you know, all his unprecedented work here in the American soccer environment. Coaches, head on over to 343coaching.com. And if for whatever reason you happen to be starting with the little ones in the 7-versus-7 environment, head on over to 7v7coaching.com. All right, that's it. Very short ads. Let's get into the show with Benny Rogers. Here we go.
I'm curious, have you ever checked out your Rate My Professor?
Many, many years ago. And ever since then, I haven't gone back. But once in a while, girl likes to visit and see what's going on there. So she kind of fills me in audio, an audio version. Why? You checked recently?
I'm just curious. I feel like if I was a professor, I would be looking at it, see what my students think.
No, I never really cared all that much. In the very beginning, I cared because I cared a lot about web development and new web applications and what were people building on the web. And Rate My Professors is one of those old school original apps, you know, that came out, original rating sort of apps. And so I thought it was quite interesting. And then over the course of time, my interest in that particular thing dwindled. It was cool because I had a lot of chili peppers in the beginning. So that was nice.
Hey, but like we talked about last week, we've gotten so soft that they took off the chili peppers. Now it's too offensive.
Now, I actually did notice that. I don't remember when it happened. Maybe it was like 6-7 years ago, but it was.
Well, I used to check to you. If the professor has one chili, I'm not taking the class.
Why? Oh, man. So good. So good. But no, what's really interesting, too, is just over the course of the years, I've noticed student postures have dramatically changed. You know, whereas whenever it was 15, 16, 17 years ago, the students kind of like in my generation, because I started when I was like 27 years old, I started teaching at the university. They were quite hardcore. You know, you went to university to study, you know, and be hardcore and and learn, absorb as much as possible and get grades. And maybe you wanted to go to medical school or be a serious engineer or scientist or something of that nature. And the quality and caliber of students has degraded over time. And I'm not the only one who thinks this. You know, all of my colleagues who have been there any length of time see it as well. And now it's just really, really bad, Benny. I don't specifically attribute it to the screens, social media, the phone. I'm sure that has a lot to do with it, or is a significant factor, but they don't come prepared to the university level like they used to.
Right.
People just get passed at the elementary school level without having the requisite competence or learning abilities or whatever the hell the standards used to be. They're not there anymore. And so students just progress up the grades without earning it. And same goes for high school. People just graduate high school, but they can barely read. They can barely write. With respect to math skills, forget about it. And even the ones who are technically inclined and then go into engineering or things of this nature, they are so substandard compared to the past. It's crazy. So by the time they get to me at the university level, like in soccer, you can't turn that ship, dude.
For sure. Well, one of the things we'll talk about later that's within the masterclass is like technical debt, right? So It sounds kind of like the same exact thing in terms of your academics, but I'm curious, does that mean, so you say the students now are less educated or not as good as students in the past? Does that mean that you have to lower your standards? Because I can't imagine, right, if you can't give the whole class a D or an F, right? Because then the university comes to you and they're like, Gary, what the fuck's going on? All right.
So yeah, the standards have gone down. And to be quite frank, my perception is when you first start as a teacher at the university level, you know, maybe you're fresh out of getting your advanced degrees and you know how hard it was for you and what the standards of your professors were. And so you come in kind of gung-ho and your standards are super high, right? And then I think there's a natural process that occurs where you naturally get softer as a professor and you become, you know, more chill, if you will. So there's that natural sort of lowering of standards that can happen or does happen. And then layer on top of that, everything that I just ranted about, you lower it even more because if you preserve it too high, yeah, you're going to get a huge percentage of people that fail, a huge percentage of people that get D's, and you know, C's are going to be harder to come by, B's even more, and A's almost forget about it. So, and yeah, there is always this looming, I don't want to say threat, you know, but there's this always this cloud of possibility that if you're too tough or too rigorous, you as the instructor might get reprimanded for that. And not only that, I think a lot of students nowadays are more emboldened by the culture that exists nationally, regionally, locally, and at the university level. They're more emboldened to complain or think that they are in the right, you know, and that the professor is in the wrong, that whatever it is that the professor is doing is incorrect or unreasonable or not fair or all those sorts of things. And I think the administrators of the school have a tough job on their hands because they also feel that pressure too, because if the administrator doesn't make the student happy, then they might get in trouble. You know what I mean? So I don't know really how they handle that, but make no mistake about it. Everybody in the teaching profession does have this incentive to drop standards for sure.
The entitlement is real, Gary, from the students. Where is it coming from? Honestly.
I think it's a national socioeconomic, political, cultural thing that has been developing in the United States for some time now. And we're kind of at the peak of all of that, where the society has gotten extremely soft. Life has been too easy, too good. And folks, as a consequence of that, don't feel compelled to work that hard as maybe our parents or grandparents or great-grandparents had to work, who struggled a lot. And I think that trickles down all the way to the bottom floor one way or another. So I don't have that answer. All I know is that I don't think that it starts in the school system. I think the school system inherits the incentives and incentive structures that are created by policy at the national level and at the state level.
It's depressing, Gary.
Well, I there's a lot of things to be happy about too in life, Ben, but if we just focus in on that particular topic, yeah, it's not great. And look, and it's not just the school level. I mean, I have colleagues, obviously, because my cohort are in their 40s, you know, so I have colleagues who are in the private sector, and I was once in the private sector, who are also sharing the same things. They're like, Gary, you know, we're hiring engineers, scientists, mathematicians, computer science people from universities, and they come in here and they are just shockingly bad workers, shockingly bad employees, shockingly low level of competence relative to the graduates of 10, 15, 20 years ago.
There's a meme that's been going around. It's like, in 15 years, I'd imagine this, you go to your doctor and you tell him all your symptoms. And he says like, all right, give me a second. Let me look up all your symptoms on ChatGPT.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, I think ultimately that's where everything is headed.
Yeah. Crazy. Anyways, all right, Gary, let's talk a little bit about the masterclass. Maybe you can tell me, where did you get the idea or the kind of the inspiration? And at what point did you feel like, all right, this is something that I need to get done? Or what is a masterclass for those people that don't know it?
Okay. The masterclass is a parent education program. It didn't start that way. And so I'll go through the history really quickly, but it's for parents who have kids in the youth soccer environment here in the United States that would like to up their level of discernment as to what is good for their kids, what is not good for their kids, and what's kind of mediocre for their kids, and how they can migrate on that spectrum from not good to very good. And what does that entail? That entails being able to discern what a good coach is versus what a not so good coach is, what a good club is versus not what a good club is, what a good team is and not a good team. And people get that twisted all the time. As you know, people immediately migrate to results. Oh, that team wins all the time. That's a good team versus the other one that is middle of the table. That's not a good team. And, you know, so we teach them to recognize things and what to look for. And most of those lessons, frankly, don't really exist out in the information landscape, the media landscape here in American soccer. It just doesn't exist. You can't get this. And usually parents, when they do end up learning a lot of things, it's too late for their kids because they learn by experience. They have their kids who enter soccer maybe at 5 years of age or 10 years of age or whenever it is. And then 8 years later or 10 years later, their kid is out of youth soccer. And the parent has by osmosis kind of learned a lot of things in those 10 years through their one child or maybe their two children, but it's too late. They're gone. And they reflect back. They're like, oh, if I'd only known this, this, and that, then I could have helped alter the course of my kid's development. And so we're trying our best to accelerate that learning process by honing in on what's important versus what's not important. Because a lot of the time in any domain, Ben, the hardest thing for somebody to learn is precisely that. What is important versus what isn't. You might spend 6 months, a year, or 5 years focusing in on something that really isn't all that relevant at the end of the day, and you waste time. So hopefully through this program, they can short circuit that 10-year experience acquiring trajectory that they have. But to get back to your question as to kind of how it started, us as coaches, Ben, or in soccer our whole lives, you go online and you know that there's personal training. You see a whole bunch of content on personal training. Oh, dribble through these cones, zigzag in and out, do this Cruyff turn, you know, on and on and on, or these juggling tricks. And people latch onto that. And as I'm looking at this content, I'm like, oh my God, all of this stuff is trash. All of this stuff isn't going to help your kid, really. You're focusing in on a bunch of drills that really aren't going to level you up all that much. And people fall prey to these sorts of courses and programs online. Look, the people who are developing them, I'm sure they have very good intentions. I'm sure they're not trying to scam anybody. But, you know, in my experience or in my opinion, they're showcasing the wrong things. They're teaching the wrong things and delaying frankly, the development of the player. And so the origin of the masterclass was like, well, actually, we're going to do this right. We're going to teach the personal training stuff, what drills actually will translate and help you or maximally help you in the game that is soccer. So it kind of started down that path. Only later, I kind of realized that's the wrong route to take, because the key to a player's development, the biggest impact is through the parents and not through coaches or personal trainers, because the parents have so much more time with the kids. And so we said, look, part of what a parent can do is be their kid's personal trainer. So we won't dump out all this content that we developed with the activities and how to dribble and do certain types of things. We won't throw that out, because the parents can always use that and help their kids with being their personal trainer. But we're going to add a lot of the meat and potatoes of the knowledge that a parent needs outside of the actual actions or training of a player for them to take onto the ecosystem and help their kids. So there you go, man. That's what came to mind.
Yeah, a lot to unpack there, Gary. For one thing, to your point about the parent becoming the kid's personal trainer. You see it so often these days. There's personal trainers charging $100 a session or $80 a session. And it's exactly what you just described. It's they drop a line of cones, dribble through the cones, or various exercises that maybe they found online. If we can empower the parents to help their kids along their way with the proper exercises and activities that they should be doing, I think it's so beneficial. And especially if you're a parent and you're spending $100 every single week, right? It's going to add up. And not only to be spending $100 a week, but to be spending that money on something that maybe is not even going to benefit your kid or could potentially be hindering your kid. So the benefit to this program, I think for parents is, one, you can understand all the things that you mentioned first, right? You can discern between what is a good team, what is not a good team, what should my coach be teaching my players? And I think that that's so helpful, and that's something that doesn't exist within this country right now. Something that I want to bring up too, and it's within the first lesson, right? The philosophy of the program is that player development can be broken up into five different components, right? So there's the structured club training influence. Next one is the household, parent, and family influence, the playing on your own influence, the pickup game influence, and the personal training influence. So maybe we can just go and break down each one, just say a couple things on it. As far as the structured club training influence, how can you discern if your son or daughter is in the right environment?
Yeah. So when you go to your club team or your team period, your kid is going there to learn how to play the game in a team environment. Okay. First and foremost, your kid is not going there. I'm going to say shouldn't be going there, but with everything, it's case by case and there's caveats, right? But I'm just going to go ahead and roll with the following. Your kid shouldn't be going to their team training, their club training, and for the entire session or sessions, just being doing solo individual sort of activities like you would receive in a personal training session. And so much of the American media narrative over the years has been, oh, we should be focusing on individual player development and not team training or team development or tactics or any of those sorts of things. And so a whole bunch of the coaching landscape and club landscape, in many ways conveniently, shifted the way that they quote unquote train teams by doing these individual activities, juggling, weaving in and out of cones, you know, doing some shooting drills, Cruyff turns, you know, rotating with the outside of the foot, rotating, all individual training is not what your kid should be doing. So what should he be doing? He should be learning how to play within the team training environment. That's not to say that you neglect all the technical development activities at all. You just develop the technique within the team context. So then that begs the question, oh, well, okay, Gary, well, how do I discern between 2, 3, 5, 10 different team training environments, which one is good and which one isn't good? And that's kind of what the course goes into, you know, and it's very difficult to describe that in an audio only podcast, which is why we developed the course, so you can have visuals of what does a good training session actually look like. You know, what is a rondo? What does it actually work on? Why is it being done this particular way? How it should look like when somebody, a player is competent or a team is competent? What is building out of the back for real? What should that look like? How should it be trained? What are attacking patterns? Why do we have patterns in the first place? You know, what does that actually look like? How is it taught? You know, what are the pitfalls? You name it, you get to see video and hear the audio of the coach obviously Brian Kliban here, educating the players on how to develop collectively, and consequently, they also develop individually. So you get to see all this stuff, and then you can take that sort of knowledge that you acquire and go into your own kids' team training environment or scout out other team training environment and take a look at how much commonality there is between the standard and whatever it is that you are actually seeing.
I hate to say this, right? But for coaches that kind of focus only on technical ability in their training sessions, and that's their main emphasis, is this masterclass is kind of like their worst enemy, right? Because it's going to open the eyes of a lot of parents to see that, hey, I'm taking my kid to a team training, a team environment, and he's only working on individual things, right? So it's kind of going to expose a lot of coaches, though.
No, 100%, and for sure. And the other thing that we aim to educate on is some things are context dependent. You know, if you have a coach that's doing this individual stuff instead of team stuff, that's fine. But are these kids, you know, 6 years old or are they 13 years old? You know, another thing is, I mean, are you doing it every single session, you know, for the 13-year-olds, or are you doing it once every four sessions? You know what I mean? So those are context questions that should be considered when making judgment calls.
One thing too that I think I remember John Kors saying this is that he trains his teams, I don't know, like four times a week. And it's all like the team environment, right? Team structure, building out of the back. But then he'll have an extra session at the end of the week, optional, right? For whoever wants to come, simply just getting touches on the ball.
Yeah, brilliant. That's brilliant. That, no problem at all. The other thing to consider, and all of this stuff obviously is covered in the program, but let's say your kid goes to a particular team and they're not doing team work for real and at any appreciable level or at any good level at all. Understand that other kids are getting that probably, or in many cases. And so your kid is falling behind from that perspective. So there's always this balancing act that exists of individual actions, which is why these five components of player development that you listed out originally. Yes. So if the other players are, you know, doing pickup soccer or are doing personal training outside or are playing on their own, and then they come to the club environment and they're also getting individual player development stuff, that's harming them. They need team training. And if they are getting the team training and your kid is not getting the team training, your kid is not learning how to play within the collective that is a team. So you're not actually learning soccer.
Right. And this is something that I tell my kids all the time. It's, as a coach, it's really easy to discern who touches the ball outside of training. Meaning like, okay, I can tell the guys that the only time they're on the ball is when you're here at practice. There's other guys on the team, the top players. I know that they're on the wall every day or juggling every day, right? Because it's really easy as a coach to discern if the players are spending any time outside of training, if at all. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And it also depends on the age of the player and the level of the player, because sometimes the coach can easily determine or see an enormous progression of a player. Like maybe a player was one of the bottom on the roster, and then a year later, they're in the middle of the roster already. That's enormous, hyper fast speed progression from somebody. And it doesn't happen magically. It happens with all these other things outside the team training environment.
For sure. And I think another important thing to note is like the longer that you wait to start doing these things, for example, if a 17-year-old decides, you know what, like I haven't been putting in that much work, but now I want to try and be on the wall every day. There's been 10 years of his life that he didn't do that. Meanwhile, other players are doing that. And so his debt, like it's almost impossible for him to catch up to the players that have been doing it since they were 7 years old or 8 years old.
Yeah. So you're introducing the notion of technical debt here. I don't know if you want to dive into that right now. It seems like a good segue. The technical debt is something that I came across, a term that I came across maybe 20 years ago when I was doing some work in software development. And when you develop software, you can rapidly prototype or deploy something that is functional into the real world. You know, the faster you do it, there's a higher likelihood that you didn't put a lot of thought into doing it right. You know, doing all the infrastructure correctly, making sure that potential bugs aren't squashed from the get-go, all kinds of things. And so let's say you take the shortcut and you just deploy it right away and you get a whole bunch of users and you maybe even sell this in the enterprise. And maybe years down the road, you know, you keep adding features and adding features and adding features. And then all of a sudden things start breaking, okay? Or a competitor comes into the landscape and you're like, oh crap, I have to re-architect and re-engineer this entire product that I developed on the fly. What has happened is that you have accrued what is called technical debt. Okay. And now you're going to have to pay the piper. You're going to have to pay back all that shortcuts, all that debt you're going to have to pay, meaning you have to go back to ground zero and do things right from the beginning and restructure, reprogram, refactor is the term of trade in software, the whole shebang. And it might be too late. You know, it might be too late. You might end up refactoring it and paying back all of that technical debt. But by then your competitor has won, okay? And so I kind of adopted that term to this domain of soccer in the sense that, like you suggested, once a player is 15, 16, 17, 22 years of age, if somebody else has been putting in way more work and correct work than you all those years, and you want to change all of a sudden, you want to change the stroke of your shot, or you want to change how you receive a ball or how you pass a ball or how you dribble or all of these things and get up to the level of your competitor who's ahead of you now, you are so screwed. You're so royally screwed because you have to pay back all of this debt that you accrued. And while you're paying back that debt and re-architecting your technique and your soccer IQ and your tactical know-how and your mentality also and your physical prowess, maybe you start hitting the gym, you want to get serious about hitting the gym all of a sudden, your competitor keeps getting better and better and better. So even though you're improving, they keep improving too, and you don't catch up. It's over. That's technical debt. It reminds me of something that I'm sure you've seen this. Kobe Bryant came out in one of these interviews, and I'm sure he's talked about it many times. Without calling it technical debt, he basically laid it out. He's like, look, I wake up at 4, I get my first workout in, and then I get my second workout in at 8 in the morning, and then the guys show up at 11 in the morning for their first training session, and I do that one with them, and then they call it a wrap, and then I do a fourth night session or something like that. So he's getting in 3 or 4 training sessions, not 2-a-days, 3 or 4, you know, every single day. And, you know, he does the math, or he did the math, and he's like, after 5 years of me doing this, it doesn't matter if my competitor, my MBA colleague says, oh, this summer I'm going to go hard. You know, I'm in the off season. You never catch up. It's impossible. Kobe is literally 5 to 10 years worth of going hard ahead of you. It's over. You can go hard the rest of your career. You're not catching up to Kobe Bryant.
And that's why he was the best, Gary. And I think people don't realize the amount of work and sacrifice that went into him becoming the best. Right? Maybe they think like, oh yeah, I'm sure he worked hard, but I don't think they realize the level of dedication and commitment that he put into it.
Yeah, they don't get it. They don't get it. I think, look, Benny, I'm not a psychologist and I'm not going to say what I think about psychology anyway, but I think it's a lot of cope from folks. I think it's more convenient to believe that somebody is just genetically gifted and that is why they have their success, or that they are simply privileged and they just received their success. Are there situations like that? Sure. Okay. I can't be LeBron James no matter how hard I try since the age of 3 and outwork him and all those sorts of things. Okay. And can I be Einstein or one of these guys? Probably not. You know, maybe there is some sort of special, unique physiological qualities that they have that I and most others don't have. But not everybody is LeBron. Not everybody is Einstein. There's a shit ton of ultra successful people that aren't specially gifted in any way or aren't specially privileged in any way or aren't trust fund babies or any of these sorts of things who work their fucking balls off, you know, for decades and failed and failed and failed. And eventually they learn from all of this failure and all of this work and all of this sacrifice. And then they pop out the other side at age 25, 35, 45, 55, whenever it is. And they're super successful. They're the top of the mountain of their profession. And so naturally, it's my strong belief that people don't want to believe how hard they work because they themselves maybe think that they work hard. And look, they never got anywhere in life. The reality, I think most all cases is, motherfucker, you actually didn't work all that hard. Let me see your Netflix history.
That's a telltale sign right there. But no, seriously, Gary, I mean, it's back to the entitlement thing, right? Everybody thinks they deserve to be the best. Or everybody thinks they deserve to win championships or go pro or get a Division I scholarship, right? But what are you willing to sacrifice to achieve your goal? Most people aren't willing to wake up at 3 in the morning every day and grind it out in the gym, two a days. And you know what I mean?
100%. 100%. Well, that's the challenge, bro. And that's why so few people get to the top.
Right, right. Let's talk about another component, Gary. For me, I think this is the most important one. I'd like to see what you think. But the household, the parent, the family influence, how that can impact the player's development. For me, in any team that I've coached, it's usually the best players are the ones where the parents love the game. Soccer is on TV 24/7 at their house. Right, they're wearing their soccer jersey to school because they've been influenced and they love the game so much, right? How big of an impact does the parent play? Does the family play? Maybe you can share some stories of players that made it far and what was their family environment.
I'm always going to throw out the disclaimer in front because I've said it many times, this is not mathematics. This isn't physics. This isn't the hard sciences where it's quite clear there's a right and a wrong answer. And it's quite clear that 100% of the time, 2 + 2 = 4, and anything else is incorrect. So that out of the way, let's understand there are some exceptions and caveats. We don't care about the exceptions or the caveats. We care about the general rules of thumb here, okay? So in the general rule of thumb, the household, in my estimation, is the most influential of them all, above the coach, above the club, above almost everything. And later we need to get into, or maybe another episode, we need to get into the gatekeeper model that exists here in the United States. Because even if everything is lined up beautifully with the five things, Benny, and the player is exceptional and amazing, the gatekeeper non-meritocracy that is American soccer can still screw the player, okay? And the player never makes it. So let's put that one in the back burner for now. But the household is the most important because that's the environment you're growing up in your formative years. And there is a reason, aside from the network and those other factors, there's a reason why the kids of former professional players end up being quite good, end up going quite far, more than the non-professional, former professional parent. And the reasons should be obvious. I shouldn't have to spit them out here. They played the game. They know how to kick a ball, right? They have all these experiences. They could guide their kid a lot better than a non-former pro or non-high-level playing person can. And so the masterclass, if we want to relate it back to that, is to try to close that gap a bit and try to give the parents a lot of the tools of the trade, a lot of the tools of discernment that these other parents actually do have. You know, if we want to talk about somebody that's obviously, I'm not picking on them, but it's a big name, the Reynas. Gio Reyna's parents were both former professional soccer players, and his father played in World Cups, you know, and played in Europe and did all these sorts of things. And so, of course, the kid has this huge advantage. And that's not to say, not to take anything away from the kid and not to go back to what I earlier said about privilege and entitlement, all that stuff. No, the kid still has to be good. Right? He still has to be good. If you suck, you ain't going to be a pro. And so I think guiding the child from the parents and the household is huge. It's critical. Does the parent have to be involved in the kid's life and the soccer life? No. Sometimes, Benny, and I'm speaking from experience, sometimes it's better if there is no parent involved in the kid's soccer developing trajectory. Because when you infuse the parent, while they could do a lot of good, they could also do a lot of harm, obviously, unknowingly so. And so in many instances, again, I speak from experience, the kid who does not have a father who's always in the business, oh, what's going on here? The coach should have done this, the coach should have done that, or we should move to this club or move to that club, or I don't think, you know, you should be passing to this kid or that kid. That father or mother is out of the picture, much better for the kid. But yeah, man, I think that second element, the household environment, is key.
I'm curious if you don't mind me asking, Gary, like, what was your guys' household environment when you and Brian were growing up in terms of soccer, right? Were your parents fans of the game? Were they always watching? Did your dad go to your guys' games and talk to you after the game about what you did well or what you didn't do well?
Yeah, both our parents watched soccer, not really played though. And yes, they both were always at our games. Growing up, very passionate on the sidelines, more my mom than my dad. My dad was a bit more reserved on the sidelines. My mom would kind of, you know, I think she would fit right in with today's parents on the sidelines in wanting to win, in wanting us to score goals, and wanting the other kid to pass the ball or when he wasn't passing the ball, all those sorts of things. You know, she can compete with the best of them there. But yeah, you know, we would talk a little bit of soccer, not too much outside of the field. We would watch World Cups together, of course. We would go to matches. You know, the 1994 World Cup was here in the United States. We went to a few of those games. So yeah, soccer loving people. Argentina obviously is their homeland, and their parents were also Argentinian. So naturally, by osmosis, that is just part of the culture. And insofar as another cultural element that I think is very significant is how critical of a culture are you? And Argentines are extremely critical people. We criticize everything, good and bad. And when things are very, very good, we don't say things are very, very good. We look for the dark spots in the very, very good. It's just that's the type of people Argentinians are. And there's bad that comes with that, no question about it. But there's good that comes with that. And it breeds a sort of culture of excellence in terms of soccer. And I think that's reflected in Argentine soccer. You know, we breed a lot of exceptional players, exceptional teams. And yeah, again, pros and cons, but that's Argentina. That's the household environment that we grew up in.
Right. The next component, and this one is kind of difficult in this day and age, but I'll explain why, but the playing on your own influence. And so when I mean that it's kind of difficult in today's day and age, like I know when you were a kid and even when I was a kid as well, it was easy to go outside and play with your friends or take your bike and ride 5 miles to the field, right? Nowadays, not so much. No parent is going to let their kid ride 5 miles and go play with their friends. But I still think there is possibility for kids, you know, to go out and play on their own. And meaning that if you have to tell your parents, like, hey, like, can you drop me off at my friend's house? Or can we go play? So the playing on your own thing, I think it's something that a lot of, especially the suburban culture, it's lacking, right? The only time that they're playing is within the team environment or on games on the weekends. How big of a component is that playing on your own?
Yeah, it's very big. If we're talking about competing internationally, it's very big. If you're talking about competing here locally, regionally in the United States, it's very important because it'll give you a huge leg up on your competition because everybody else, like you said, isn't really doing that. So it gives you a huge advantage, but maybe it's not as important if you're never going to compete internationally, you know, because whatever, your other colleagues here in the States are deficient in this category as well. Having said that, it's hard for me, and I think almost anyone, frankly, to judge how much or how little this is happening. So I'm here in Southern California, and I can tell you that for the generation of boys that became famous, right, through Brian and the video and all that sort of stuff, they were born 2000, 2001, 2002s, and they were predominantly Mexican-American, Latino-American. I can tell you for sure that they were playing on their own, irrespective of everything that you laid out moments ago, whether it was riding a bike or walking, you know, to a nearby park and playing some games or kicking the ball against the garage door, kicking the ball against a racquetball court. They were doing that, or having their dad, when they came home from work, you know, just drop them off at a park, you know, with a bunch of friends and just bounce, or whether they were doing it in school during recess or something. And then all these things were actually happening. They were playing on their own, and lo and behold, yeah, they gave them a huge leg up. Technically, tactically, savviness, mentality, all that sort of stuff that, let's just say, kids from other cultures didn't have growing up. Now, let's fast forward to 10 years. Okay, so now we're talking about maybe kids born in 2010, 2017, 2000. Maybe it's happening even less so nowadays than with the kids born in 2000. And so, okay, it's just something that we have to live with. This is not something that really can be changed. But I guess the point I was trying to make, it's hard to judge how much or how little is happening because nobody gets to live in all the areas of the country. I'm here in Southern California, okay? I don't know what's happening in North Dakota. Maybe in North Dakota, parents do let their kids ride their bikes 5 miles to the local grocery store to pick up some eggs, you know what I mean, and come back. I don't know what's happening in the Carolinas or what's happening in Oklahoma or regions of Texas. And nobody better come to me and say, oh, Gary, I know exactly what's happening in every part of the country here. I call bullshit on that. So point well taken, Benny. I think that is the current lay of the land here in the States with respect to playing on your own. You don't have to ride your bike. You can just go outside and just juggle, you know, in your front porch, in your backyard, or whatever it is.
Right. Well, the next component of the development that you mentioned, right, is the pickup game influence. For me, as a kid, some of my best memories is the pickup games that I would play with my friends. I remember me and Danny, we used to, I think you came too with us one time. We would go every Tuesday morning at 7 a.m. futsal, right? And within those games, I feel like is where I learned like the intricacies of like the dark side of the game, meaning stuff that like your coach will probably never teach you. Like, I don't know, pulling on a player's jersey or like fucking smack talking or somebody smack talks on you, right? That is where I learned all of those little intricacies that don't exist here within U.S. soccer, right? And it's just so funny, Gary. Like, those are my most vivid memories. And even going with Danny and all of his team when they would play at the Boys and Girls Club in La Habra. And I remember, like, they would get down with the other guys that came. There would be, like, fights. You know what I mean? I think if, as a parent, if you can put your kid within that environment, whatever you feel is a safe enough environment for them, I think it's such a powerful tool for players. And that you hear the best players in the world, Neymar, Ronaldinho, Messi. They swear by the streets, right? They learned their craft, their creativity, everything they learned from the streets. So the pickup game is huge, I think.
It's the best, dude. And my fondest memories are those memories also. Playing pickup on the weekends or late afternoons, evenings with other kids from school or neighborhood kids or friends like, you know, you and Prieto and Choco and Jacob and all these guys. You just get together and you just have at it. And it's mixed ages, obviously. I had 20 years on you guys, you know, so I would bully you guys around a lot, which is also fun. But that's part of it too, you know, because you get to cope with all the shit talking. You get to cope with, if you're the little kid amongst, you know, bigger kids, you have to be able to handle that and handle, you know, frankly, the bullying that could exist too. Bullying, like, in a loving sort of way. And sometimes it could get serious, you know, but I think it's part of human development in many respects. I remember because growing up, I had a park across the street from, you know, my parents' house. And right across the street, there was basketball court. And I would go and play pickup basketball since being a little kid. And so, I don't know, maybe I was 12, 13. And, you know, there were adults there, 18-year-olds, 17-year-olds, 22-year-olds playing games. And sometimes whenever I get in on a game, you know, you cope. They're like, hey, little man, you know, they in a loving way, but also kind of trying to toughen you up a little bit. And those are some of my fondest of all memories. You know what I'm saying? And then the flip side of it is at some point you become the big boy on the block and the roles are reversed. And so you get to learn that side of the equation too, growing up. So all of this goes into development, which ultimately leads to your club environment. Are you the star on your team? Okay, that's like you being the big man during pickup games. Or are you the, you know, on the bottom third or bottom fourth of the roster, and then you're little man, you know, on your club team. So if you're playing pickup, you understand all facets.
Yeah, and Gary, I was always the fucking little man when I would go with Danny and Prieto, and like I loved it though, you know, because hey, like, I would score a goal or do like a sick move. And to them, it's like, hey, what, fucking Benny, sick ass fool. Like, you know,
totally.
But at the same time, if you fuck up, they're going to be on you. Like, you know,
for sure. Or if you
lose, you're off the court, you know, so they're pissed at you. They're like, fuck you, Benny.
It's the best, man. It's the best. Or if you, as the little man, embarrass somebody who's right above you, all of your teammates who are older and the big boys, they clown on that guy forever. For the rest of that night, that guy is getting clowned on.
For sure.
You know, and I remember a particular instance, again, playing pickup basketball. I was a little kid, man. And whatever, somebody was supposed to be guarding me. You know, I'm sure he was like 20 years old or something like that. And look, taking it easy on me for obvious reasons. But I just received a pass and I shot a three-pointer, you know, and the guy kind of like raised his hand like he was going to fake guard me. And he let me shoot a three-pointer and bam, swish. And that fool got clowned on the rest. He's like, oh my God, little man squished into three-pointers. I still remember it like it was yesterday, dude. The rest of that night, they would not leave that guy alone, dude. He was clowned on forever.
Going off. Hey, but honestly, Gary, it's so true. And it really builds a strong mentality for you. I mean, you have no choice but to have a strong mentality, right? And so for me, like, I would start going when I was in, like, I don't know, like sixth or seventh grade, right? But by the time I got to high school, because as high school, as a freshman, you're going to play against seniors. You're going to play against people that are 4 years older than you. But for me, I was like, no problem. I've been playing against Jonathan Prieto, Choco. Like, this is not a problem at all. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, and massive coping problems, dude, with a whole generation of players that are fortunate enough to graduate to the next higher level after youth. And it doesn't have to be pro, okay? So I'll speak generally. It happens to people graduating to the pro level, and it happens to people graduating, say, to the college level, E1 level or something. They roll up there, and now they're either the rookie at the pro level, a child, you know, no experience, nothing, or they're a freshman at the college level. And maybe they were the star on their youth teams and they played, you know, academy, they played internationally, they maybe even made youth national teams. And they find themselves riding the bench and being little man all of a sudden. And they can't fucking cope. You know what I'm saying? So it's as if they've never experienced these things ever. They've always been big man, you know, and always the guy in charge. And most of them break and fold. And here again is where the household environment is crucial for them to survive, you know. So they get to these environments, and if they can't cope, and you don't have a father or parents to kind of straighten you out, you know, and set you straight, then it's almost likely game over for you. So at this point, unfortunately, it falls on the household and the parent family influence at that point. Nobody else can save you from that situation.
The last component of player development that you mentioned in the course is the personal training influence. Right. And we've talked a little bit about this already. I think if you find the wrong personal trainer, somebody that doesn't know what they're doing, it can severely hinder your child's development. So one, what's the importance of finding a good trainer? But even better than that, how beneficial is it for a parent to have access to this course and to know what they should be looking for in a trainer, or they themselves become the personal trainer?
Okay. A lot to discuss there. Number one, first and foremost, I believe the more contact a player has with the ball, the better. Mm-hmm. So even if you have a shocking personal trainer, at least you're getting ball contact.
Yeah.
Okay. So let's put that out of the way. It's better than nothing. Now, with respect to, could that actually be doing damage? In a certain perspective, it can, because you could be wasting your 1 hour of personal training with somebody. Now, let me reframe that. Instead of having a crappy personal trainer for 1 hour, and getting touches, just, and that'll help you, but you're just getting touches, you're wasting that 1 hour that could have been allocated to a great personal trainer, a good personal trainer that will actually work on things that will legitimately help you. So give an example, an extreme sort of toy example. Let's say that you go for personal training for an hour and all they have you do is juggling, and they teach you how to do juggling tricks all day, and you get really, really good at juggling. Okay, are you going to be juggling in a game? No. The degree to which you are good at juggling, while good, is not directly translatable to being a good soccer player. There are many, many players who are 100 bajillion times better jugglers than Lionel Messi, okay? People doing backflips while not letting the ball drop, you know, doing all kinds of things, and Messi can barely do anything at juggling. Put that juggler on the field and it's a clown show, okay? So that's just a toy model to make the point that while you are increasing your contact or your touches with the ball, you might be doing harm because you're wasting your time on things that are irrelevant or not very important. Okay, so that aside, what was your question again? That was the only part of it.
No, I'm saying, what is the benefit of a parent having access to this course?
Oh,
you know?
Yeah.
For them to discern what is good or what is not good, or if they themselves have the time, they can become their kid's personal trainer.
Well, yeah. I mean, look, if you're part of the program, you're able to see and better identify all kinds of things. One example is we have a module that talks about what are good left backs? What do they look like? What are good center backs? What do they look like? What skills do they have? What are midfielders? What are the good skills that are important for a midfielder? Like video examples, so on and so forth. And very subtle, nuanced things that you just do not receive in mainstream content or all kinds of information that's out there online. You don't get it. Does it exist? Maybe a little bit in little discrete pockets. But 100,000 pieces of content are not that, are garbage, and there's one. So it's a needle in a haystack situation that parents are confronted with and getting the signal from all the noise that's out there. And how does that help? Well, let's say that your kid plays left wing or right wing or something like that. Okay, you get to zoom in on precisely what are the important, nuanced skills associated with a good winger. And then there's personal training activities that will develop those specific type of skills versus the toy thing, like, oh, go and juggle or go kick a ball against the wall randomly or senselessly. No, let's zoom in and hyper focus on what makes a particular player develop maximally in a position specific way as well. So I think that's very valuable. And I think in the context of personal training, it's very valuable to, when you go with a personal trainer or multiple personal trainers, to observe and see, hey, what are they doing with my kid? And I'm not going to say you're going to be capable of judging them correctly necessarily, but at least you're better equipped to kind of maybe even ask the right questions, you know, associated with a particular personal trainer. Because then you have some background, good background, to say, hey, Steve, you know, why this exercise? Help me understand. Or what do you think of these exercises or whatever, Benny? So we're trying to arm the parents and give them a sword and a shield to better allocate their dollars towards their kid.
And I think that's what a lot of personal trainers are missing, is kind of zooming into, like, what I love about the masterclass course is that it breaks down every single position. Hey, my son or my daughter is a six. All right, let's zoom in on the top sixes in the world. Let's see the activities they do. Let's put the emphasis on receiving the ball across your body or these types of different touches on the wall. And I think what a lot of personal trainers, not their goal, but what they do is, like we've already talked about, it's a line of cones, dribble through the cones, or it's just repetition on passes, but the player's not understanding within the deeper context of the game.
Yeah, and there's just so many things to contemplate. Something that could fool parents a lot in the team environment, or the club environment, which was topic number one, and this personal training environment, there's a lot of superficial metrics that can lead them to believe this person is good versus this person is bad, or this team is good versus this team is bad. And one of those is like social proof. So let's say that you train or have trained professional soccer players or former professional soccer players, unbeknownst to the parent, that really doesn't say all that much. You know what I mean? But it's quite impressive. Oh, wow. Like, you train so-and-so and you have a video of so-and-so training with you and you're having them do some finishing drills or this or that. I mean, I get it. If I go into a field that I know nothing about and I see somebody working with famous people, it's like, oh man, okay, I want my kid there, you know? So we're trying to help parents, again, arm themselves to, and that's not to say that they aren't great personal trainers, but at least now you can make a more educated decision.
And I think a big misconception is that, especially with Brian, right? A lot of people will say, like, oh, well, maybe Brian only had his success because of the players that he had, but Alex Mendes was not Alex Mendes when he came to Brian, right? And all the work that Brian did, and not just work on the training field, but I know from experience, right, as one of Brian's former players, it's constant education, right? Hey, gentlemen, today I'm giving you this homework assignment. Go home and look up this player, or look at the way that this guy shifts his body when he's receiving the ball. It's nonstop education and communication to the players. And I think a lot of people don't realize how much time that Brian spent and how much time, energy, love, affection that he showed to these players that really made them what they are today.
Yeah, and being able to inspire them too, because if players aren't inspired, they aren't going to do what they need to do. The other thing that is notable, and again, the public doesn't know this sort of stuff, and there's no way they could know it, is if you look at the teams and the players that Brian was competing against, they were extremely good teams, extremely good players. And what happened to those players? They don't exist, okay, for the most part. And this is something that I cannot prove, obviously, but I know it to be true. I know it's a reality. If the roles were reversed and those other teams' players were on Brian's team and Brian's players were on those teams, well, all these players, you know, the Ulis, the Alex, they wouldn't exist today either. And the other players would exist. They would have gone very far. Of course, I can't prove it. Of course, it's like, okay, Gary, sure. I'm just telling you that is reality. Look, environment matters, okay? The platform that you're associated with matters. So if you're of equal or greater talent than a lot of these guys that Brian had, but you happen to be born in South Dakota or Nebraska or in the outskirts of the Carolinas or Georgia, or whatever the case may be, you're not in the right real estate, it doesn't matter. You don't exist, and it doesn't matter. You know, you can do all this personal training and, you know, household environment is amazing and pick up soccer is right around the corner and you're killing it and crushing it. You do not exist. You know what I'm saying? the chances that you make it are practically zero. So I'm just throwing that out there as an extreme sort of scenario to better appreciate my earlier claim that if Brian's players were on FC Golden State or on Patadores or on Irvine Strikers or on Real SoCal or these other clubs, and those players in those other clubs were part of Brian's group, those players would have made it, and Brian's players that didn't make it wouldn't have made it. And look, please don't get it wrong, not to discredit the hard work of Brian's players and their families. All of that has to be in play for sure, but the environment is important too.
And well, Gary, here's the really cool thing is that now with this, anybody can be a great player. Anybody can go on to become a pro if you can properly implement this and if you have the right work ethic, dedication, right? Obviously, there's a lot of factors that go into somebody becoming a pro. But think about, okay, so all those players that weren't on Brian's team in the past, imagine if their parents had access to this today. It's kind of like you're on Brian's team or you're being coached and trained by Brian Kleiben. You know, any kid from North Dakota can have access to these lessons and kind of be influenced by Brian in the same way that Brian influenced his players and
parents.
Parents, right? And look at how far they've come. You know what I mean?
Yeah, but they're still screwed if you don't have the right platform.
Right.
Which is the bigger picture discussion that I mentioned at the very beginning. We won't get into today. It's American soccer is a gatekeeper-driven ecosystem, and you have to be the right place at the right time, and the right people have to like you, and the right people have to elevate you, and all of the stuff that really screws over American soccer and American soccer families.
That's a big topic. That's a whole episode in and of itself. No?
It's a book. It's the book that I need to write. Let me see have we forgotten anything? What do you think? Let me see. Oh, yeah. Just to briefly mention on the pickup soccer, we actually tried to create a pickup soccer program.
I remember that.
Maybe it was like 6 years ago, 7 years ago. And what it entailed is basically, okay, so there isn't much pickup soccer around here. And especially for the suburban families who don't want to let their kids, you know, ride their bike 5 miles and God knows where they're at. Like, okay, maybe if we formalize this, this is something that the suburban culture is accustomed to. We created a program and the parents could pay. I forgot what we were charging. I think it was maybe $300 or something for like 15 sessions, which is ridiculously cheap because again, it was just a concept at the time and we wanted people to participate and we wanted to provide a service, you know, that was lacking. And basically we had 15 sessions or 15 weeks, maybe it was twice a week, once a week. The parents could drive to a field that we had acquired, drop off their kid there. They can stay if they like the parent, but they could drop off their kid with adult supervision, which was me and our coaching staff and other kids in the program. And then we would just set up pickup games and just let them have at it, you know. And while kids were sitting out of pickup games, we had another little station with some of our coaches running some sort of personal training activities and so on and so forth. And so when the pickup game would end and the next group had to jump in, we kind of would rotate, you know, so it's kind of formalized. It's not true pickup soccer culture because you have adult supervision. So you lose a little bit of that, but we try to let the kids take over as much as possible. We try to let them pick their own teams. We try to let it go wild. You know, we didn't ref the games. We try to let them self-regulate, all the things that happen in a real environment. And we had a good group of people that joined. I think it was like 40 or 50 people that joined. But over the course of time, you know, less and less and less people would show up. And by the end of the program, we still had it quite functional. There were still 15 kids showing up or something to that degree. But in and of itself, that fact that the attendance dwindled kind of communicated, we learned something, right? We learned something. It's not all that important to most people here. If that makes sense. And then secondly, we rarely ever receive any sort of complaints, but it always exists in any business. One particular parent came up to me after maybe it was like the fifth or sixth session. And they're like, I don't understand what's going on here. You're just sitting on the sidelines, not doing anything, not coaching, you're just letting them run around and do whatever the hell they want. I'm like, look, that's literally what we want to do. And that's literally how we marketed the program. Like we're trying to create a real authentic pickup culture. And, you know, they weren't happy and they never brought their kid back. So I'm like, all right, I don't know if they were expecting 343, which is this special brand to nurture their kid one-on-one one and teach them. And no, that's not what this is about. So you still have that suburban sort of expectation associated with it. So you lose that authenticity. I still have hope that something like that could be created, Benny, but I don't know. I'm skeptical now.
I have a feeling the demand would be more popular for that in like lower income areas or areas where soccer is the number one sport. You know what I'm saying? Here, it's like, oh, let's go play baseball or let's join a flag football team. But, you know, in areas like, you know, downtown Los Angeles, where you drive by downtown LA on some of the courts that you see, and there's always kids playing right there. You know what I'm saying? And I know the parents would be down for that for sure.
Yeah, but see, the challenge, and this is a whole other episode, we should talk about this, is about the soccer economy. Yeah, because look, as much as I want this to exist in the world, I'm not going to work for free, Benny. And you need to staff this thing. And how am I going to staff this thing and tell the staff, the coaches, or whoever's going to come over, oh yeah, you're going to do it for free. You're going to volunteer. It's just completely unreasonable to expect people to not be compensated for their extremely valuable time. Number one. Number two is that here in the States, particularly in Southern California, if you want a field or if you want a little place to do your thing, you're going to have to pay for it.
Yeah.
So I have to pay per hour to have a plot of land to do this. Okay, well, who's going to put, you think I'm going to open up my wallet, just gift, you know, whoever, hundreds of dollars per hour, you know, for this thing, and I'm not going to get any income whatsoever to cover that, at least cover it. Come on, this is not realistic. And so when you mention, yeah, of course it would be awesome in the environments that you're suggesting, but is that demographic going to pay for their kid to participate in this? Probably not. And so you're stuck. So this is a broader conversation. You're stuck with a customer base, the suburban soccer customer base, to fund this sort of operation. And so you're not getting the kids that are from that particular culture who are totally in love with football, that's in the blood, you know? It's a different demographic that you are now servicing. And so we have this vicious cycle where, again, exceptions aside, the demographic that is all about soccer, the huge Mexican-American population, the huge Latino population, they're kind of disenfranchised, right, from participating in these things automatically. And the ones who are given a leg up are the ones who don't really care all that much. You know, they might be chilling with their dad to watch Monday Night Football, you know what I'm saying, instead of watching Champions League or something like that. Mm-hmm. So it's this vicious cycle that we have in the States. It's very tough to break, man. The only way to break it is with promotion, relegation at the professional level.
Everything ties back to that, Angry.
All of it goes back to that, bro. Well, that's it for today, guys. Thank you for listening. A reminder for coaches, you can get both the free and premium coaching programs at 343coaching.com. Don't let anyone tell you your teams can't win by playing dominant possession-based football while also developing individual players to the highest levels. Nonsense. We've proved it at every single level, and so have hundreds of serious member coaches across the country. Now that we've moved on to the pro level, we're delivering everything we've learned in the program. Don't wait and continue delaying getting on a proven path. And parents, 343masterclass.com is where you want to go to get a working compass for navigating the American soccer landscape with your player. It's pretty bad out there, but let our experience guide you. Lastly, if you're coaching 7v7, we've got you covered there as well. Go to 7v7coaching.com. Until next time, cheers everyone, and keep building.